How are you all today? Welcome to the Second Court of Appeals. We have one case on our docket, on our 130 docket for Wednesday, May 18th, 2016. We have Northwest Independent School District versus Carroll Independent School District. We're hearing it virtually in reference to two cause numbers, a mandamus and an interlocutory appeal, 216-010-CV and 216-014-CV. And I understand everyone's checked in and asked for their time. So if you all are ready to proceed, we are.
May it please the court. Charles Crawford for Northwest ISD. The purpose of this mandamus and appeal is to clarify what the parties are trying on remand after the corrected judgment and the three en banc opinions. The court's order directing entry of the corrected judgment did not give the reason for that entry, but did state that the court's June 19th opinion stands unchanged. As Northwest interprets the opinions, four justices, a majority, held that the county line established in the Tarrant County-Denton County litigation cannot be declared to be the school district's common boundary line on remand, and that the remand is limited in this respect. Carroll ISD disagrees and argued successfully to the trial court that the remand is without any restrictions or limitations, and that the court can try and determine that the school district's common boundary line is the line established for the first time in the Tarrant County litigation, and that the so-called disputed area is located within Carroll ISD's boundaries. Northwest believes that this exceeds the scope of this court's limited remand based on the opinions of Chief Justice Livingston and Justice Dauphineau.
Dauphineau.
That's all right.
And I believe your statement of what the first statement of what the four justices said may not be accurate. So I wanted to reserve my rights on that.
And we understand that. Okay. And in fact, that's the purpose of why we're here, because the parties in the trial court obviously have really disparate ideas about what the court sent back. Again, Northwest's position is it was a narrow, limited remand. As Chief Justice Livingston said, in her opinion, our remand is limited to that determination and is therefore properly provided for in this narrow remand, i.e. where the actual boundary line that both parties agreed to, voted on, approved, adopted, and have recognized for 60 years. And Justice Dauphineau agreed with that, that the remand was limited. She didn't agree with the remand, but she agreed with that the remand was limited and enjoined Chief Justice Livingston's opinion in many respects. And that joining with the Chief Justice's opinion forms a majority of four that tells the district court, the trial court, and the parties what we are to try on remand. And as we understand the opinion, and again, that's why we're here, for clarification.
I'm not in that four, right?
I understand.
Okay.
In fact, your opinion makes very clear that you're not in that four. And one of the reasons you're not in that four is because you believe that Carroll is not trying to do by a declaratory judgment what they can't otherwise do.
Correct.
And in fact...
Sounds good.
And we would ask you, Justice Garner, to reconsider that opinion. And the reason why is, as Chief Justice Livingston said in her opinion, the law of the case doctrine is discretionary with the court, and the court can change its decision if we have subsequent pleadings that change the relief sought. And so when you decided in the first instance that the law of the case doctrine didn't apply because Carroll was not seeking to annex or detach, you were relying on the pleadings at that time. Subsequent to the en banc opinions and the corrected judgment, Carroll re-amended and filed a sixth amended petition that alleged ultra vires claims. And as part of those claims, Carroll asked the trial court to enter an injunction with prospective injunctive relief to prohibit Northwest from taxing in the area, issuing bonds, educating children, and governing the area, because according to the new pleading, the disputed territory is located within the boundaries of Carroll ISD. And that's exactly what Chief Justice Livingston said and Justice Dofano said they can't do. Because, and I'm quoting from Chief Justice Livingston's opinion, if Carroll is now claiming the disputed area, despite its acquiescence for over 60 years, you are trying to do by declaratory judgment what you can't otherwise do. And so we think that the new pleading, adding these ultra-virus claims on the assumption that the territory, despite their historical acquiescence, is theirs, they are now asking for a de facto annexation and detachment. And so we would ask the court to revisit your opinion that that's not what they're seeking in this case, because under their new pleading with these new ultra-virus claims, that's exactly what they're trying to do. They are trying to have the court declare that what Northwest has been doing in this area for 60 years is illegal and unauthorized and is not allowed by statute or law. And they've been doing that for 60, and so it's directly contradictory to what the four of the members of this court said in the en banc opinions, which you can't do that. And so we believe that, again, Carroll is trying to do by declaratory judgment what they can't otherwise do, which would be either annexing and detaching or challenging the results of the elections or collaterally attacking the commissioner's court's orders that announce the results of those elections. Any one of those events is an improper use of the Declaratory Judgments Act, and therefore we think the court ought to revisit that issue, find that in light of the new pleadings, in light of the new relief being sought, that they are, in essence, asking for a detachment and annexation. And this was recognized in the very first panel opinion that Judge Dofano authored and Chief Justice Livingston, you were part of. The concept that when these school districts were created, they had a definite physical point on the ground in 1949. And they used a descriptor for it. And in your mind, that descriptor then became vague because of subsequent events, but it didn't change the fact that when the school districts were consolidated, there was an actual point on the ground that the court and the voters meant. And that point on the ground can be marked on the ground. And it is essentially the taxing line, which is the white line.
Let me ask you a question. How do y'all get to that conclusion or that premise that there was a line which could be marked on the ground or that was marked on the ground in 1949 for Northwest, right?
Well, we didn't say it was marked on the ground. We said that they meant a physical location on the ground, and they used an inexact descriptor for that.
Okay. I understand that argument. But if it was able to be located on the ground in 1949, where were the meets and bounds descriptions for that?
I didn't hear that part.
Where are the meets and bounds description for that?
That is not in the record. So what we understood the purpose of the limited remand would be for the court to appoint a surveyor and have a surveyor mark on the ground where that line is.
Okay, well, in the 2002 decision, Tarrant County versus Denton County, this court held that there was not a specific location on the ground that was adequate to mark the boundaries between Tarrant and Denton, and that is why we had that lawsuit. Four counties came together, entered into the interlocal agreement, and at Denton County's request for assistance from Tarrant, Dallas, and I guess Collin, and under the statute that was used, they would not have been able to do that, to have it surveyed and located on the ground if there was already one located by prior law, but this court concluded that there was not, and so they did have a new survey done, and the location on the ground that was found by Jackson was then adopted by agreement, and then this court adopted that. That's my understanding.
A couple points in response to that.
Okay.
First of all, in the Tarrant County, Denton County case, the reason why the court enforced the line that ended up being the line is because Denton County agreed in the interlocal agreement that the line at that time was not established and not well-defined. They tried to back out of that, and the court held you agreed to that contractually, and you entered commissioner court's orders saying that, and then you cannot now come and collaterally attack your commissioner's court orders. And so,
and the
counties had to agree to that to be able to fit within the statutory scheme of 72009, because if they had not agreed that it was not contractually agreed to that and didn't maintain that it was well-defined, they wouldn't have been able to do this.
Correct.
So that's the first point. The second point is this deals with the county line for purposes of the counties, but we're talking about a school district line, not a county line, that merely happened to have a descriptor that is now vague. But we can mark it on the ground because we historically have acted where the line has been. And in addition, under 72009, the line established by the district court shall be treated as the true boundary between the counties unless the court determines the line in question was established under prior law.
Mm-hmm.
And again, this deals with counties. If we are talking about school districts, in 1951, the legislature passed Article 2815G-46. This was cited in our original appellate brief. And that did two things in 1951. One, it says the boundary lines of any and all such school districts are hereby and in all things validated. And then in Section 2 of that article, it goes on to say then that all school districts have the ability to levy and collect taxes in those areas. And so under prior law, the school district line did exist in 1951. And so unlike the county line that might make it subject to 72009 because the parties agreed that they didn't have, here under prior law, this line existed because it was valid in all things validated in 1951 by the Texas legislature. And so we have an existing line that we can mark on the ground under prior law, and it's the school district line. And as Justice Dofino made the point in the original panel opinion, the fact that the counties agreed to a line does not necessarily mean the location was not definite for school district purposes. And it was definite for school district purposes because it had been validated, and we can mark it on the line, and the parties, and the jurisdictional facts are undisputed that in this area between the two lines, what we've been calling the disputed area, Northwest has been the only entity to levy and collect taxes. And the appraisal districts, their evidence is in there. And by law, the appraisal districts within their records have to identify the governmental unit that's the taxing authority for land. They've identified Northwest as the taxing unit for this land based on the historical records provided to them by the school districts.
And Mr. Crawford, let me ask too, isn't the school district line, I guess it would be the most southerly line at this point, isn't it just a tiny portion of the entire length of the division between the two counties?
We're not talking land-wise significant. We're talking about 800 acres, and I think the line goes about 3.5 miles across. But we're talking about significant tax dollars, and that's what this is about. This is about tax dollars and the value of the property. And we don't have in the record the current numbers, but in 2007, the tax impact to Northwest was almost $1.4 million annually, and the property had an assessed value of in excess of $100 million. And so we are talking about what Carol was asking by their new pleading in their ultra virus is to shift from who's taxing and collecting $1.5-2 million in taxes a year on this property is going from one school district to another school district. And the only way you can do that is if you're changing the ownership of the property, ownership being a loose term.
I'd like to ask you a question. If I didn't misunderstand you, I thought you said a moment ago that Northwest Independent School District thought that the case was being remanded to have a surveyor appointed to...
Well, ultimately...
Where did that come from?
The court, when the court remanded the case, this court, and said what we're left with is where on the ground is the existing boundary that the two school districts have recognized and acquiesced to for 60 years. In practicality, how you do that is we hire a surveyor, he marks that line, and then he reports to the district court, here are the meets and bounds description of the line that I was told to find on the ground. That would then answer the question. The court could then enter a declaratory judgment that the historical line that has always been recognized is on this meets and bounds. And so we think that's what the court told the district court to do.
So you think the line is based upon the fact that it's been acquiesced to for 60 years.
That's one of the reasons, and we believe four justices of the court made that determination in the en banc opinions. That would be Chief Justice Daffino's opinion, I mean, Chief Justice Livingston's opinion, and Justice Daffino's concurrence. And that concurrence joined the majority opinion in many respects. And my understanding is the chief criticism was you didn't think the case should be remanded at all, because the exact relief being sought by Carroll in that the pleading existed at that time, the relief that there hadn't been pled. And so you didn't feel that there should be any remand at all. Chief Justice Livingston thought that, well, what they've asked for is a subset, or what we're remanding is a subset of what they asked for, and therefore we can remand it. But it was a limited remand, and it wasn't to declare that the school district line is the 2002 county line as a result of the county's litigation. It should be where the school districts have historically treated it, and there is ample evidence where that is. We don't have a meets and bounds description of where that is, and we thought that was what the court was telling us to do when we went back to the district court, was find that line on the ground, district court, trial court, you enter that declaratory judgment, and we're good. But Carroll has gone beyond that, because they are now asking for ultra-virus claims. And again, I believe you said it very clearly that, from your opinion, I also agree with the majority's decision barring Carroll from asking the trial court on remand for a declaration that the county line established in Tarrant County is the district boundary line. And that's exactly what they're doing in this case. And so we believe that in interpreting the corrected judgment using the opinions and using a majority of four justices in interpreting that, that what Carroll is asking for and what the trial court has agreed to try the case on exceeds the limited remand from the court, and that is the subject of the mandamus.
So you're asking that we interpret that as an ultra-virus act, and then also that the trial court still retains jurisdiction to hear the actual boundary line location, whether it's by survey or some other means. So are you really saying that the ultra-virus pleading is really the same lawsuit, it's just got on a different hat?
They have asked for new relief.
Okay.
Which is different then. We believe it's different. That's why we believe that you ought to reconsider your law of the case analysis. Because before, that request for relief had not been pled yet. And so the ultimate relief we're requesting of the court is to revisit that and to dismiss the case for want of jurisdiction and render. However, if the court is not inclined to revisit the law of the case and is inclined to remand, we would ask for a narrow remand that is very specific and instructs the trial court that the school district's line can't be the 2002 Tarrant County-Denton County line. It has to be the historical line as surveyed by meets and bounds.
But isn't, aren't both school districts, when they were created, don't the documents adopted by the county commissioners of both counties say that the boundary, I mean, isn't this why we're here? They say that the boundary is the Tarrant County-Denton County line, and that's the problem.
Well, the, it, well, yes and no, Your Honor. It's a descriptor, and what it says is once it points this line, it says then you go fence south to county line between Denton and Tarrant counties, fence west alongside county line to a point, and then you go down. And so that's what it says. And clearly, you know, school districts, when they're created, have to have boundaries, and they have to have definite boundaries. And the reason why they have to have definite boundaries is because we, the school districts have to know who's educating the kids, who gets the tax money, who gets to build the schools, who bonds it. And so when Northwest, and by the way, Northwest was a consolidation of existing school districts. It wasn't created out of, it didn't create a new school district. It was a consolidation of already existing school districts. And so that line was already on the ground. I mean, there was a definite spot on the ground where Hazlet ISD ended or Roanoke ISD ended, and they were consolidated. The problem is we just don't have in the, we don't have in the records, because these records are extremely difficult to find. We tried. Sure. And that's why if the court decides to remand, what we ought to remand is let's get a meets and bounds where that historical line is, because that is the line. That's the line that's been recognized. That's the line when the county commissioners created the school districts and they put those notes, those call notes in, they didn't say, for example, it goes along the county line as may be determined later pursuant to Article 1385, which was the predecessor statute to 72009. The counties had the ability to figure out if they had a dispute at that time. There was that same mechanism in place. They did not build that into the school descriptor. So they meant a definite line, that, and they meant a line that it, in 1949.
How did they know then? How did the counties know where the, this historical line that existed for 60 years was?
Well,
how did they operate under it to know where on the ground it was in order to tax the right families and homes, I mean.
Well, that's
students
not,
and so forth.
I mean, that's not in the record, so I can't answer
that.
That's
probably
but,
one of
I mean,
the questions.
I think the simple answer is they knew where it was because that's how they operated. And they knew where the line was because Northwest taxed on one side of the line, Carroll taxed on the other side of the line. Or when it was the other school districts, Roanoke taxed on one side of the line, Hazlet taxed on the other side of the line. So they knew. And they knew when they create, when they consolidated this, they weren't creating new territory, they were just consolidating existing territory. And that territory, again, was validated for in all things for taxing purposes and for the authority. And if you look at that article, it talks about the validating the authority of the commissioner's courts and of the trustees and of the superintendents. And so under established law, the school district line was established. We just need to know where it is on the ground by meets and bounds. And again, we believe that was the intent of the limited remand, not an unlimited remand without restrictions. And that's what the trial court has said that he is going to try, because Judge Chuck was very, you know, open about it. He said, I want to let everything in and get the entire record so that when it goes back up to the Court of Appeals, they'll have the full record and they can render. But that's not what the court did. The court instead sent a limited remand, and Judge Chuck has to respect that. Otherwise, he's exceeding his authority that you have given him to decide the remainder of the case. And so we think he is, by trying everything, including the ultra-virus claims, including the request for a declaration that the school district line is the new county line, are things this court, in its opinions, said that can't be tried.
Mr. Crawford.
Yes, sir.
Is it your position that an ultra vires pleading the ultra-virus pleading in the Sixth Amended Petition constitutes an attack on the 49 election?
Yes, Your Honor.
Thank you.
Unless I have, if the court has any more questions, my time's about up. And
well, on your rebuttal, though, will you please address how you believe that our Murphy v. Reynolds case supports your position? I think you cited that in your briefing.
I will need to look that up while I'm at the table. Reynolds versus Murphy?
Yes.
Thank you.
All right. Mr. Gilstrap.
May it please the court. I'd like to clear up, first of all, a couple of misstatements. We are not seeking injunctive relief. We're seeking declaratory judgment. Read our pleadings. That's all we're asking for. Ultra-virus, that's a red herring. I mean, Justice Dolphin, when she wrote the panel opinion, raised the specter that the school district might be immune. We went back and read the law that had arisen since our lawsuit was filed, Heinrich and Sawyer's Trust. And they say the way you overcome the immunity problem is you sue the officials in their official capacity for ultra-virus acts. We went back and sued the school trustees in their official capacities for the ultra-virus acts, but the Supreme Court has said that is the same as suing the school district. It added nothing. Finally, I would like to talk about do something council did not do very much of, and that is actually talk about the issue before the court. He talked about the merits of the underlying dispute, and of course we all want to talk about that, but that's not the issue here. The issue is the scope of the remand, and that requires you merely to decide what you did when you handed down the en banc opinion back in 2014. It's not a rehearing. It's not a redo. The court has the power to do that, but I submit it shouldn't exercise that power at this time. It should wait until we finally get what we've been trying to get for 10 years, a trial record stating what all the claims they are, what claims they're making, this business about the validation statute. I don't recall ever hearing that. The point is we can't decide the merits until we have a complete record. Insofar as the scope of the remand is concerned, he didn't mention the key document, the corrected judgment. You start with, if you look at the scope of the remand, you look at the corrected judgment. That's the only judgment of the court. And instead, the court, when it issued the corrected judgment, it did away with the original judgment. The original judgment did limit the scope of the remand. It said, we reverse to the extent that we are challenging the consolidation elections and the subsequent commissioner court orders in an attempt to move the existing boundary. Obviously, that limited the scope of the remand. But that order was vacated, and the corrected judgment was issued. It says just the opposite. We affirm. I submit to you, you don't have to read further than that. On an interlocutory appeal, once you affirm, the ball game is over. The case is remanded because it affirmed that the trial court did have jurisdiction, the only issue before the court on the plea of the jurisdiction. Once the trial court has jurisdiction, we can try a case on the merits. That should be all. The court did go on and say, to the extent that we seek a declaratory judgment regarding the meaning of the orders and judgments creating the actual boundary location between the two school districts. That's the relief we've been asking for 10 years now. We say that the 1948-49 consolidation election set this county line as a school district boundary. We say that the agreement that the school district boundary was finally determined by the result of a 1987 agreement between the counties and a subsequent lawsuit, Tarrant County versus Denton County. And therefore, the school district boundary is on the county line as established by Tarrant County v. Denton County. That falls clearly within the scope of this language. They ignore the corrected judgment. They want to talk about the Chief Justice's opinion, the so-called majority opinion. We call it a lead opinion. I'll quibble about that in a moment. But the point is this. the Chief Justice's opinion is in conflict with the corrected judgment. I mean, my goodness, the Chief Justice's opinion says, the corrected judgment says there's no error. The Chief Justice's opinion says there is error. The corrected judgment remands without limitation. The Chief Justice's opinion clearly limits the scope of the remand. The case, the opinion and the judgment are in conflict, and the rule of Continental Airlines versus Kiefer says that when the opinion and the judgment are in conflict, that's the end of the story. The judgment controls. He wants to invoke the rule of Hudson against Wakefield, which says that, well, we got to look at both the judgment and the opinion together. There's two qualifiers on Hudson against Wakefield. It obviously is not applicable if there is a conflict, and there clearly is here. Second, it is can only be applicable where you have a majority opinion. And you don't have a majority opinion here. Three judges signed the Chief Justice's opinion. Three judges are not a majority of a seven-judge court. They say, oh, we can count Justice D'Alfano's opinion. They even call it a concurring opinion. Well, Justice D'Alfano did not vote to remand, so she cannot have anything to say about the scope of the remand. Here's what she said. She said that I disagree with the majority's decision to remand the case to the trial court to allow it to consider the request for declaratory relief about the location of the boundary line. So that left the court divided 3-3. Three judges in the Gardner opinion said, you know, affirm. That's the end of the story. Three judges in the Chief Justice's opinion said, remand, but limit the scope of the remand. What do you do? Well, there are four alternatives for the court. After we filed our motion for rehearing, Justice D'Alfano could have changed her opinion and joined one of the two groups. She stood by our guns. That still left three judge. Well, there's three alternatives there. First of all, the court could hand down an opinion, say the court is evenly divided, therefore the underlying ruling is affirmed. That's exactly what the United States Supreme Court is having to do these days because it's divided 4-4. That's an established way for appellate courts to proceed. Didn't do that. Could ask the Chief Justice Heck to appoint a tiebreaker. They do that with the Supreme Court and occasionally in the Houston courts. Didn't do that. What was left is the six justices had to agree on the language of the corrected judgment. And you know, we cite the case of Marks against United States, which says how you're supposed to do that. The six justices are supposed to get together and find something they can all agree on. But we don't really have to look at that. We know what the six justices agreed on. They agreed to the corrected judgment. The corrected judgment does not limit the scope of the remand. And what counsel has not answered, and the question I'd like him to answer on rebuttal is, why did the court issue the corrected judgment? There's only one explanation. It meant for the corrected judgment to control the case. Now, what they want is basically for you to go ahead and ignore the corrected judgment. They want you to look at the language from the Chief Justice's opinion and really put it back in the judgment. But then why did the court issue the corrected judgment? Under their view, that would become a meaningless act. Now, I'd like to talk about the merits. The underlying case, the county commissioners in 48-49 said that the school district boundary is the county line. There's no requirement that the county line be marked on the ground, and it certainly isn't referred to as marked on the ground. It's an old surveyor's term. It's called a floating prairie line. When you're out there in the prairie and you're trying to say, well, I'm going to go over here to the Smith and Jones survey. Well, that doesn't mean the Smith and Jones survey has been defined. It means it goes to the survey wherever it is. That's what they were doing in 1948-49. And it made sense because we had by then a full century of dispute as to where the county line was located. There was the white line, and their surveyor says, well, when the county commissioners meant the sub-county line, they meant the white line. They're having to backpedal on that now because they're now saying, oh, no, it was the taxing line. Well, the taxing line is not the county line. It's located to the north of the county line. And it didn't even exist till 1986. And I guess the point is, this case needs a trial. Judge Chuck may be newer to the bench than some judges, but I think his observations here are sagacious. This has been up twice on appeal. And if they have their way, it'll go back and we'll come up again without a full record. And by that time, a couple of years from now, maybe the court will have changed further. We don't know what's going to happen. Doesn't it make sense to try the thing on the record now? Get all the evidence, these missing surveyors that said, these surveys that have suddenly appeared. After 10 years, they're not in the record. Try it on the record, on the facts, and let us decide it, and then you can review it with everything before you, and you can decide it. Instead, the lead opinion in this case, I took a different route, and I do want to address that. Remember, all that was before the court was a plea of jurisdiction. The merits were not before the en banc court. Well, how did the merits have to do with the jurisdiction? Well, that was through the famous, now infamous, election contest theory. Their theory was that we should have filed our suit as a contest in the 1948-49 election because they established the location of the school district boundary on the ground, and we didn't do that. We waited about 60 years. Of course, Carroll didn't exist at that time. There were various approaches taken. The panel opinion was one, but the one that remained was in the Chief Justice's opinion. And that theory was the acquiescence theory. They said, we're trying to challenge the location of the line as it's been acquiesced to for 60 years. Well, the evidence of acquiescence only goes back 30 years to the taxing line in the 1980s, but it didn't make any difference. Now, there's problems with that. School districts can't acquiesce. Neither could Tarrant County. All the arguments that they're making today were applicable in Tarrant County versus Denton County. They had a line that everybody thought was the county line, the white line. Didn't make any difference. Or at least a lot of people thought was the county line. So the acquiescence theory is flawed, and here's the flaw. The acquiescence could not have begun, they say, we acquiesce. We didn't exist till 1958. That was when Carroll ISD was created, 10 years after the consolidation election. Now, that's a theory. They can try to sell it in the trial court, but what on earth does that have to do with the election, which happened 10 years earlier? The fact that let's suppose that there was acquiescence, and we're challenging the line that was established by, quote, acquiescence. What does that have to do with the election? It doesn't have anything to do with the election. There's an enormous disconnect there. What would we have done? We would have gone back and said, well, we represent a school district that's going to come in, be created in 10 years from now, and we're going to acquiesce to the line, and now we're trying to change it. That would be the election contest that we would have to file. That is, candidly, an absurd theory. That's the problem with the decision that was handed down, the Chief Justice's opinion. But we're not here there to relitigate that today. The issue is the scope of the remand, and it's clear that the scope was not, the case was not limited on remand. They cannot explain the corrected judgment. The corrected judgment is the act of this court. That's all you have to do. It may be that your views of the case have changed over the last couple of years. It doesn't make any difference. You're not here to re-decide the case. You're here to decide what you did in 2014, and that's an easy call. That's all I have. Thank you very much.
Can I ask a question,
please,
to maybe clarify in my own mind what you're saying with respect to the lead opinion?
Yes.
Would it be accurate to summarize it, your argument at least, as saying, okay, that appeal was from a denial of a plea to the jurisdiction.
And all three appeals have been.
In an appeal from, or in a plea to the
jurisdiction. Yeah, well, go ahead.
Excuse me, I'm sorry?
The first one was an appeal from a grant to plead to jurisdiction.
Yeah.
But they've all been jurisdictional appeals.
This was an appeal from a denial, and that in a plea to the jurisdiction and an appeal from the denial of a plea to the jurisdiction, the merits of the case are not in issue.
That's exactly right.
And so would it be accurate to say, excuse me, I'm sorry.
Sorry, no, go ahead, please.
My follow-up thought was that to the extent that the lead opinion then purports to establish the merits of the case, it's what? Is dicta?
I think it is, because what did the court decide? The court decided to affirm and remand without limitation. That was all that was decided. And yes, the opinions stand unchanged, and they're probably argued, hopefully, in a couple of years after this case is tried on the merits. But the fact is, insofar as the merits are concerned, the en banc court decided nothing because it's fundamental. The Court of Appeals cannot decide the merits on the plea of the jurisdiction. The only way that they got there was the election contest theory. And I haven't heard any answer to our argument that if there was a boundary by acquiescence and we are challenging it, it had nothing to do with the election, because acquiescence could only start 10 years after the election. They can't answer that question. But I'll be glad to ask
I have
some
a
more.
Question on the corrected judgment. You're looking at the one that was issued September 11th,
yes.
2014.
Yes.
There is language, though, that remained in that judgment, and it allows the case to go forward to the extent Carroll seeks a declaratory judgment.
Yes.
So in that respect, is that not still a limitation?
Well, I have two comments on that, Your Honor. First of all, I'm not sure, and I always hate to tell a court it didn't have the power to do something, but I'm going to say so here. I think once you affirm Judge Chubb's order, you don't have the power to limit it. But the point is, to the extent that you do have the power, our lawsuit falls right within that language. We are seeking a declaratory judgment regarding the meaning of the orders and judgments, that is the consolidation orders and the judgment in Tarrant County versus Denton County, regarding the meaning of the concerning the creating the actual boundary between the two school districts. It did create the actual boundary. It set it on the county line. That's the actual boundary. That's what our lawsuit's about. The court allowed us to try. Now, if we had come back and come up with some new theory, like, for example, trespass.
Like ultravirus?
Well, no, ultravirus is not a new theory.
Oh, it isn't.
No, it isn't. It isn't. It's simply another way to sue the state. And that's what the cases say. The suit is still against the state. Justice D'Alfano raised the specter of immunity in her panel opinion. We addressed it right away. That's how you do it these days. It's nothing new.
But it's new to this lawsuit.
What's that?
It's new to this lawsuit.
Yes, but it doesn't change anything. You don't sue the governmental entity necessarily alone. You sue the official actors in their official capacity. That's how you do it. If we had had Heinrich decided in 2009 before us, we would have done it differently. But this case started in 2005, and that was how you did it then. Any further questions?
Yes, I have another one. Please. What about Murphy v. Reynolds and how it impacts you all in connection with its directive to look to both the judgment and the underlying opinion in a matter?
Well, Murphy against that, those cases are merely spinoffs of Hudson against Wakefield. That's the original case. And it obviously doesn't apply when the judgment and the opinion conflict, right? I mean, it only allows you to use the opinion to clarify the judgment. So it's not applicable here. And, of course, we have the problem is it can only be applicable to majority opinions. Obviously can't be applicable to a dissent. They want to add Judge D'Alfano's dissent in here to create a majority opinion. And I think that's not only incorrect, the court realized that it was incorrect when it handed down the corrected judgment. You've already decided all these things, not in public, but obviously in conferring among yourselves. Your decision has been made. Just say what it is, and let's move on.
Okay, Frank, I'm just curious about something. Essentially, what y'all are trying to do is just get more taxable real estate, right?
Well, actually, taxes are involved, but counsel left out an important thing, and it's an odd thing because if you're not, don't actually deal with the school districts. The real issue is the students.
Okay, yeah.
Because of the equalization formula. That's really what the battle's over. And there's I think, we showed 170 students in...
I have a question, Frank. Yeah. My question is, all right, you've got meets and bands going north-south, right?
Yes.
And you've got it on the east end, you've got it on the west end.
Yes.
Are you going to extend those meets and bounds to make them longer so you'll capture your northern border, or are you going to lower your northern border because your southern border is lowered?
We will come south to the Tarrant County line wherever it is located. We believe
you're not going to change the other meets and
no,
we've got
you
meets
don't
and bounds
to.
North the north no, and south ones
to,
on
because
either end.
And you know if we'd had to, their surveyor would have been all over it. But no, you just come south to the county line, west along the county line, and then south to Farmer Brown's line. There is nothing in there that says where the county line has to be.
Right, but my question is, does that change your north-south meets and bounds?
Your northern
boundary is going to be south of where it...
Yes, the call was not south, 50 virus to the county line.
Mm-hmm.
It was just south to the county line. Wherever it may be located. That's how you do
it. Say wherever it may be located?
What's that? It doesn't say that.
It just says...
To the county line.
Just south to the county line.
South to the county line. And that's how you do a floating prairie line. You say south to the Smith versus Jones survey. Implicit wherever that may be, if it hadn't been located. Then west along the county line, then south, and doesn't say how far. It doesn't say south 300 barrels to... another marker, which is south of there. But again, what we're sorting through is the type of issues that need to be decided.
I'm just curious about the overall effect.
I believe that your question points up an important aspect of this case, and that is we're all eager to get in here and interpret that survey and figure out where the county line is and what they meant. And we're jumping the gun. We haven't even heard from the surveyors yet. What do they say? How you draw these things? They have a surveyor who said, well, it the county line was the white line. They meant the white line, but now he says, oh, they meant the taxing line, which is not the white line. Those are the type of things that need to be sorted out after a trial on the merits. They don't need to be the subject of speculation on a partial record, which is what we all want to do.
Actually, we're trying to figure out your pleadings.
Well, our pleadings simply say we want a declaratory judgment as to the location of the school district boundary.
And they're trying to figure out our judgment.
Well, I submit, Justice Gardner, that that is a simple thing. You just got to pull it out and read it. It says affirm. It allows us to try our suit. What more do you need?
That's it.
That's it.
If we said had said affirm, period, it would automatically be a remand.
Right. Right. And of course, it's a plea. It's an interlocutory appeal. And when you affirm, that it's an implicit remand. And my theory has always been you don't even have to say remand. I think you just ought to have to.
That's what I'm saying.
Yeah, you just have to say affirmed. But the point is that it's a simple matter to read the judgment. And I don't know why we have to spend all this time revisiting the merits of the case. Well, I'm sorry, after 10 years, it's still premature. Any other questions?
I'll ask you, I'm looking at the corrected judgment.
Yes.
And you're continuing to reference that the corrected judgment says we affirm.
Yes.
Well, there's other language after that where it's talking about we affirm the trial court's denial of Appellate Northwest Independent School District's plea to the jurisdiction to the extent that Appellate Carroll Independent School District seeks a declaratory judgment regarding the meaning of the orders and judgments creating the actual boundary location between the two schools. Now, you concerned me a little when you made a reference to this court's power a moment ago. We're at the point here where we are again considering the corrected judgment's language, and it's your interpretation that with that language in the corrected judgment that the case flows back to the district court to try to piece together what that corrected judgment meant in terms of going forward with litigation, but essentially only has one effect, and that is to remove the Northwest Independent School District's plea to the jurisdiction.
Right.
Am I right in what I said?
That's right. That's
so
right.
Everything's open again as far as anything except the issue of a plea to the jurisdiction.
Well, the plea to the jurisdiction has been decided, and that's really my position is that's all the Court of Appeals can do on an interlocutory appeal is to affirm or deny the plea to the jurisdiction.
So it's open to other pleadings, other activities, well, whatever the trial court allows in terms of the law of the case based on the corrected judgment. It's only taken out the plea to the jurisdiction. That's it.
Yes, that would be my theory under my view of the limited powers of this court. However, if the court disagrees and says that it does have the power to limit the scope of the remand, the fact is that this language describes the relief we're asking for. It may be that we can't go back and say ask for a trespass to try title suit because that involves title land. We're not involved title to land. But we haven't amended to ask for any further relief. We just want a declaratory judgment as to where the county line is.
Thank you, sir.
I believe my time is up. Thank you so much.
Thank you. All right, we'll have Mr. Crawford.
Thank you. May it please the court. Chief Justice Livingston, to address your question to me as I was leaving, which is to describe to you Reynolds versus Murphy in the effect. Reynolds said two things. One, it said that when interpreting the mandate, the court is to look to the opinion also. It also said, and this was cited in Justice Dofano's concurring and dissenting opinion, that when, as in this case, an appellate court limits its remand of a case for consideration of a particular issue, the trial court is restricted to a determination of that particular issue, and you're not allowed to amend pleadings to go beyond that. And we believe, with the ultra vires claims, that again is what they've done. I will note that Mr. Gilstrap said that by their ultra-virus claims, Carroll is not seeking injunctive relief. Let me quote to you from Carroll's motion for en banc reconsideration in this case. They say, if Northwest is immune, we can still sue its trustees and superintendent to restrain ultra-virus acts prospectively. Accordingly, if Northwest is immune, our case should be remanded so that we can amend our pleadings and seek prospective declaratory and injunctive relief to prevent the Northwest trustees and superintendent from educating students and collecting taxes in the disputed area. First of all, in your en banc opinion, you did not find Northwest was immune. In fact, you denied our plea of the jurisdiction in that respect. And therefore, there was no need to file an ultra-virus claim on the basis that the court found we were immune. So that basis for the rationale for filing an ultra-virus claim is, in fact, not true. And again, it was represented, the reason, so that they can have prospective injunctive relief to prohibit Northwest superintendent and board of trustees from exercising the very acts they've been doing for the last 60 years. And if that is not moving territory from one school district to another, that doesn't exist. You are clearly, in reality, moving territory from one school district to another if you are having the court declare and enter prospective injunctive relief that says you can't do that anymore.
But aren't you getting into the merits of the case?
And that is another point I'd like to make, Your Honor, and that is the Supreme Court in the State versus Luck case, which was a whistleblower retaliation case, made clear that the court may consider for jurisdiction the elements of a statutory cause of action against a governmental entity. In other words, this is a declaratory judgment action against the school district. It is a statutory cause of action against the governmental entity. The Supreme Court has said
that elements, but not the proof on those elements. And you're asking us to consider the proof on those elements.
Because if they are seeking by declaratory judgment what they can't otherwise seek, there is no jurisdiction. So to the extent the court is looking at the merits from that aspect, that goes to jurisdiction. It doesn't go to the merits. If the facts show that the territory has always existed and been treated by the parties as existing in Northwest, and then they are asking for declaratory judgment and ultra-virus that is not the case, then the court should get into at least some of the facts that will detail if they've always been doing this in the territory, and makes this case in effect an annexation, and that is the reason behind the declaratory judgment. The court can go into those facts to decide the jurisdictional issues. And so to the extent that we are talking merits, it's in the context of a statutory cause of action to see whether there's jurisdiction in the first instance.
But we don't have a record of evidence to establish those facts.
I believe we do. We have the deposition of Dr. Faltes, the Carroll superintendent. We have the deposition of Woody Boykin, the Tarrant County Appraisal District. We have affidavits from several school district officials that said who educated, who taxed, who bonded, who all that. That is in the record, Your Honor. And those are undisputed facts. And so, in turn, you know, a plea of jurisdiction, if the court is to consider evidence, it turns into, then there's a summary judgment. And so the court can make that decision if the facts are undisputed. And here the facts are undisputed that for 60 years, this territory we're talking about has always been Northwest's. And if that's what the facts show, then it shows what this really is either an annexation, election contest, or a collateral attack. And if that's the case, there is no jurisdiction. So that's how the merits and the jurisdictional facts meet. And so the court can consider those as long as it goes to, can they bring this action in the first instance? Is this an annexation disguised as a declaratory judgment? If it is, then the trial court doesn't have jurisdiction. Mr. Gilstrap talked about the you know, the math on the opinion. We don't have a majority opinion. We only have a lead opinion, and that can't be used to interpret the mandate. In our reply brief, we cited the case from the Court of Criminal Appeals that made clear that in extreme cases, and this is probably an extreme case, an opinion can be part majority, part plurality, and part lead opinion. And when you look at what Justice Dofano said when she says, I join the majority opinion in this respect, I join it in this respect, I write to clarify it. You have four justices that agree. And according to the Court of Criminal Appeals, you can cobble that together and we have a majority opinion. And the majority opinion tells us to what extent we can have a declaratory judgment action. And Justice Meyer, I agree with you. The judgment, the mandate, is limited because it has that qualifying language that what we're trying is a declaratory to the extent that it creates the actual boundary on the ground. And so there is a limitation. And so what does the court mean when it says to the extent that? We look to the opinions. And the opinions clarify what you meant by that. And what you meant by that in our interpretation is that Carroll cannot now try what they're trying to try. And to correct Mr. Gilstrap, Carroll was not created in 1959. The 1959 election simply incorporated Carroll Common School District number 99 into an independent school district. So it already existed. It already had its boundaries. And it was already operating historically like we've always been in the past. So the 1959 election regarding Carroll simply made it an independent school district. It didn't create a new school district.
When was Carroll created?
I don't know. It might be in the call notes, but I don't know that, Your Honor. But at the time, in 1959, it was known as Carroll Common School District number 99. And as I understand it, once you get to a certain level of students, then you were able to incorporate into an independent school district. So that's what it did. It changed the nature of the entity, but it didn't create the school district. And the boundaries were already in existence. So it didn't, in those descriptor calls where it talks about the county line, they had already been operating under that for a number of years. Clearly, you do not need an ultra-virus cause of action to simply declare on the ground where the line is. And that is why the ultra-virus claim that they brought after the court's opinion injects new relief and is a new cause of action. The court's already said we can have a declaratory judgment to declare on the ground where the line is. You don't need an ultra-virus claim for that. In fact, it goes beyond that. Now you're trying to capture territory that you have historically acquiesced to. And again, Chief Justice Livingston has said
aren't
that's
they really just alternative claims for relief?
No, Your Honor, because again, the premise of the ultra-virus claims was, well, if Northwest is immune, then we should be able to go after the individuals who are acting.
Exactly, that's an alternative claim. In other words, in a plea to the jurisdiction, if a potential ultra-virus claim existed and wasn't conclusively negated by the pleadings, we would have to remand to allow repleading anyway. So how is that just not an alternative claim for relief?
Because again, Your Honor, that their claim does not simply ask for the court to declare a line on the ground. Now they're asking for actions to be declared illegal. And ultimately, it's their attempt to have the court award them tax dollars. And that is not the subject of a declaratory judgment action on we're just not sure where our line is. It is a completely new cause of action that seeks new relief. Ultimately, again, while we're here, why we are here is because the parties are clearly at a disagreement as to what you meant. And we're asking the court to take this opportunity to clarify what we're trying, if anything. It is Northwest's position that it is a, if you're going to remand, it should be narrow. It should be to direct the trial court to hold evidence as to where on the ground the historical line is and to mark it and to declare that the school district line. Anything beyond that exceeds the scope of the remand, and the court should direct the trial court not to consider.
What, where does the word historical come from as a word defining the line in this case? Is that from something in some order somewhere, or did somebody testify to that? Where does that come from?
Sure.
Historical.
I will quote you from Dr. Faltes, the Carroll ISD superintendent, where we asked him that if the 2002 county line becomes the school district line, and then he, and I'm quoting him now, then yes, where we have historically thought the line was has moved. So Carroll's own superintendent has told you that where the historical line was will move if the court declares the 2002 county line as the school district line. He said it will move. Historic, where we've historically considered it and treated it, will move.
Is that in a deposition, did
yes,
you
ma'am,
say?
Yes, ma'am, it's page 53 of Dr. Faltes' deposition.
Okay.
Any other questions from the court? Well, then I will see you the rest of my time. I don't know that I can spend much more time saying where's a line and not a line. Thank you very much.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Crawford. And Mr. Abernathy, we appreciate you being here. Mr. Gilstrap and Mr. Jondro, we appreciate you being here, and we appreciate your arguments and all your briefing. Your case is now submitted, and we will adjourn court.